Yeah, speaking of sports and its connection to mythology, I don't know if Google's logos are regional or not, but have you guys seen Google's logo?
I saw that last night, yeah. For the Jackie Robinson 42.
Yeah.
Right in the middle of the Google.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah.
That's
I thought that was so perfect because here you have not only the culmination of the 42, obviously this Jupiter thing, which has followed you around, followed most of the Sinkheads around, but this idea of sports, and to me, what is Google? But Google is sort of like, in a weird way, it is the pulse of the hive mind, right?
Well,
so
the word Google comes from Douglas Adams.
Does it really?
Yeah, Googleplex. Google it. Google meaning, I guess. Yeah, there's a whole explanation of that. Yeah, it blew me your mind. It's the computer from Douglas Adams.
I'm sorry, I just have to cut you off. Like, just probably a week and a half ago, we looked up Wikipedia on Wikipedia. Someone wanted to know what day Wikipedia was started. Like, when was the actual launch day of Wikipedia? Because someone said, oh, I think Wikipedia's birthday is around now. I'm like, Wikipedia's birthday? I'm like, how do we find that out? Look it up on Wikipedia. So we should Google and look up Wikipedia on Wikipedia. There seems like there's some sort of lesson here. I'm not quite sure what it is.
Seems like there'd be an inherent conflict of interest in
the Yeah. So I just want to point out, you guys mentioned Parnassus and this sort of storm around something. Just for what it's worth, Parnassus, obviously the movie was made by Terry Gilliam, right? If you look at an older film of Terry Gilliam's, which often gets overlooked because it's not really that good, it's not one of his better ones. No, Fisher King is fantastic.
I just watched it. I've been meaning to talk to you about it, Alan, but go on.
Oh, God, I love that movie. I love that movie so much. Time Bandits. Has anyone seen Time Bandits? So that's Terry Gilliam also, right? Now, in it, they're trying to get to this sort of, like, this weird, like, source, but there's also, like, this weird, like, heart of darkness, and it's this, like, island of evil, and basically, it's so... so precise, and at this point, I think after watching Parnassus, we know that Terry Gilliam is there on a certain level. A lot of this stuff is not only, we can say, intentional, but well informed at the very least, right? So, but he does construct a world where it's sort of this, there's a sea, and then there's this island of evil, and then there's sort of heart of darkness, and you break through that shell, and then you get into the center, and that's where they find God. Like, literally, is where they find God.
Yeah, so, and you can see right on the cover, you can see the mountain piercing the edge of the world at the tip.
Yeah.
Which is like in The Meaning of Life. So you have, 42, The Answer to Life, the Universe, and Everything. But in Monty Python's The Meaning of Life, there's the first section of that by Terry Gilliam where they go off the edge of the planet, that the planet is, they were wrong about the planet being round. The guys who set out.
Yes.
Okay. Anyways, I don't know. No.
Well, so check this out. I just watched this week. I was staying when I was down in North Carolina. I was staying in this like kind of like bed and breakfast, only without the breakfast. I guess just a bed. You know, it's like
a hotel.
No, it's like I don't know. It's like some converted house that they broke up into like rooms, and they rent out rooms, and they kind of like have like communal space, and it's nice, but you know, they don't feed you, but it's just, it was really nice, whatever. It was like, basically we weren't sure if we were going to be traveling with all our stuff, and we have a cat, and so my wife looked up like pet friendly hotels and things like that. This is a place where they have dogs, and a lot of people who come either have pets or whatever, and so it's just a pet friendly place. And it was really, really nice, like right on the outskirts of Asheville. And it was really interesting because it's actually a resort. So, of course, we have like Paul Levy waking in the dream, right? So just this, again, all these like weird sinks around everything. But I'm there and they have this thing. They say, we don't have cable TV, but we have like tons of DVDs that you can borrow. So, like, if you want to watch any DVDs. So we watch these, like, weird movies that we normally wouldn't watch. I actually didn't even watch that many movies, but we'd watch probably a movie every night nearly, because everything closed so early there, and then we're just like, okay, and we have all these DVDs. So one of the things I watched was A Fish Called Wanda, which I haven't seen in years. And so I didn't realize that, like, John Cleese was so involved in, like, he's like writer, producer, star, you know, all this stuff, right?
Oh, yeah.
So as I'm watching it, I'm trying to figure out, like, I'm not the guy who finds, like, Masonic imagery in everything, but dear God, I was watching this movie and I was like, wait a second, at some point this has got to be intentional. So, and it's really interesting. So, like, we have John Cleese, play, his name is Archie. So I'm thinking Arch Masons, and then I realize, oh, architect, right? Like, the grand architect. Basically, what he has is you have, like, all the British guys. So you have, like, Archie, and then you have the stupid American guy. His name is Otto. Well, what would that be? Is that the OTO? Is that, like, a swipe at the OTO? Basically, throughout the thing, it keeps saying the guy Otto thinks that he knows so much about philosophy, and they keep saying, you're wrong. You keep saying, you know, it's like, no, you pretend to be so well-informed, but you actually don't know any of these things. And just the whole movie is, like, covered in, like, 33s, arches, fucking,
totally.
Fucking crazy.
And then it's A Fish Called Wanda, and then, okay, what was the...
take that. So they're basically that there's two animals that are heavily featured in the movie. Obviously the fish, right? But we also have dogs. It's fish and dogs. So we have the Dog Star, or the Dogon fish people from the Dog Star, right? Sirius. This is the Star of Masonry. Fish and dogs. I mean, it's like sort of. It just, once I realized what I was watching, or I don't know, once I saw it through this lens, let's say, because, again, you know, I think that's probably a more accurate way to say it. You know, you can watch anything through any particular set of eyes or through any perspective, and you'll see that that perspective is perfectly valid.
Yeah.
Doesn't necessarily mean that it's the right one. But once I sort of saw it through the Masonic colored glasses, it was, like, pretty intense.
So you said his name is Otto in the film. I'm trying to remember. Kevin Kline, right? So Kevin Kline's right. Character is Otto, but then Otto, in Repo Man is Emilio Estevez's, character, which I was just thinking about, when, Joe, you were likening the thing to the vine on the wall, and that the wall is what assists the vine. Then I thought about the part where he's talking about a lattice of coincidence, which is so perfect for Sync when the guy Miller is talking and he burns diuretics, a joke on Dianetics, right, in the fire, and he's all like, it's like a lattice of coincidence that lays on top of things. Like, suppose you're thinking about a plate of shrimp, and suddenly somewhere out of the blue someone will be like, plate or shrimp or plate of shrimp. No explanation. No point in looking for one either. It's all part of a cosmic unconsciousness. And he goes through this whole thing, and it was just funny because that was Otto, you know. I just want to jump in here really quick and say that Google was originally, as the number which was come up with for a very high number, was actually spelled G-O-O-G-O-L. And the first place to spell it G-O-O-G-L-E was Douglas Adams in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So there you go. Anyway.
That is really fucking interesting.
I just want to say, in Fish Called Wanda, the object of everyone's affection was born a hermaphrodite in real life, right? Jamie Lee Curtis?
Right.
Was
well,
she
not,
really?
not a hermaphrodite. She just had the little nub.
Well, it's good enough for me.
Yeah, it's relatively common, okay? She just happens to be one of the ones who got publicized around that. But yeah, she's got the little extra thing there.
And her husband is Kevin Kline, so you have your KK right there.
Ooh. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Oh, dude, because once I, basically they break into the play. That's where I that's sort of the way I was looking at it first. Is like, here's Kevin Kline as the KK, and when he like they first break into the bank, and you see they're disguised as like something cleaners. They're like a cleaning company, but it's like probably like, whatever, something with a C. So let's say it's like Colonial Cleaners, but the logo is CC. Well, what is, you know, C being the third letter? So like, here's KK pushing the 33, and I'm like, oh, pink 33. Right?
11-11 for the 33.
Actually, she's not married to Kevin Kline. She's married to Christopher Guest, isn't she?
I don't know anything about Jamie Lee Curtis.
I forgot to mention to Mark LeClaire last week that I had watched. Okay, so Trading Places with Jamie Lee Curtis. There's a whole thing around the orange juice 9/11 thing that Mark LeClaire wrote about. It was total genius, and I played around with that for a while in my head. But then I was watching Amy Had Never Seen Coming to America with Eddie Murphy. And there's the part where he walks up and it's Mortimer and whatever, the two guys who were the scammers in Trading Places, and he gives them a bunch of cash that belonged to Arsenio Hall, and he drops it on them, and he goes, "Mortimer, we're back." And it was just funny because that movie takes place in New York, but the only time in the film where you see the two towers that I could spot was during that scene where it's the Trading Places, and it's right behind them as he hands them the big wad of cash. Which was just like, it was funny because that was, out of all the things that were piled up around Trading Places and the 9/11 thing, that was one that I don't remember ever being mentioned.
Think about that. So this is a huge sink for me because I was actually just talking about this. So Coming to America, right? He's looking for a queen. His father is Darth Vader and the king from Lion King, and you know, has the loaded a figure as James Earl Jones is the actual king in Coming to America. He's not only the Lion King, he's the king in Coming to America. So Eddie Murphy's the prince, right? But he says he's looking for a queen. One day he'll be king. He's looking for a queen. So he goes to Queens, New York. That movie was actually filmed where I just moved from. The last 4 years I've spent in an apartment. Oh, Bill, I was talking to you about this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where I lived in Coming to America, the McDowell's that he works at is like a few blocks from the apartment that I lived at for the last few years.
It's not called McDowell's, is
No, it's actually a Wendy's. It's a Wendy's. But yeah, it's like that's where I lived. So now bear in mind, so I lived on 77th Street, right? Now I just moved. I just got an apartment in North Carolina. Guess what apartment I got? 33 is my building number. So it was crazy. So there was two apartments I was going for, right? One is 33, and the other was an apartment building called the Monroe. I didn't get the Monroe. I got the one that's on 33. And it's funny because it's the name of the street is called Starnes Street, which I have a sort of sink around, but whatever. It's a really short street, and then there's like a highway, and then on the other side of the highway, that becomes Elm Street. So basically, I'm on 33 Elm. Well, Elm is where JFK was shot.
That's about to say, yeah.
So I'm like, are you serious? Like, my options are like the Elm Kingkill 33 or the Monroe? And I'm like, what the fuck is this? So I have this whole weird thing. Yeah, so just to point out, weird personal synchronicities around that, but just to say, if when Eddie Murphy drops all that money on him, he's basically right. He's like rebuilding the Twin Towers. Those guys are they literally are the fallen. If they're right in front of those Twin Towers and they have fallen from grace, and now here comes Eddie Murphy to sort of rebuild them back to their former glory. It's just huge.
Yeah. Totally.
What is this? Wendy Torrance's maiden name was McDowell?
No.
They say that?
That's just funny to me.
You're joking. Okay, you're joking. I was like, is that in the book or something? I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah, but Malcolm McDowell. Oh, of course. course, Eddie Murphy works at McDowell's.
Yeah.
Like Malcolm McDowell?
Yeah, and I was also thinking of Andy McDowell, who's been coming up a lot around the Andy Moonchild idea. Andy McDowell is a woman who's in Groundhog Day. She's the Shekinah in Groundhog Day.
Sex Lies and Videotape.
What's
very
that?
Familiar with her.
She's in Sex Lies and Videotape.
Yeah, she's in a lot of fucking movies, but I was considering her role from. I mean, I've taken apart Groundhog Day quite a bit, and I know you definitely have too, Alan. And that was like, that was pretty significant to consider her as, you know, the whole Andy is the name of Rosemary's Baby, and therefore the Moonchild, and then looking at her in that part as the Shekinah and him as the Zaire. And that they don't actually get to continue outside, out of the loop until there's the reconciliation between Tiferet and Malkuth as such. So
there's something particularly fascinating to me about Andy McDowell. I don't know why exactly, but I would love to be a creepote around her tree. don't know why.
Something. Okay.
So,
yeah.
So Joe, talk to us here. What I want to know is, obviously I missed the beginning of this call, and so I'm sort of not sure what ground's already been covered. But I'm curious, with the last video you made, this sort of dark rift of the soul, which I think all your videos are just so goddamn good. Hey, wait, stupid question. Who's the... Oh, no, that's the other one. In Back to the Future 3, who's Doc Brown's wife?
It's not McDowell, if that's what you're thinking.
It's, yeah, but it's someone like that.
It looks kind of like her. Clarence Clayton is her name. I can't remember who the actress is, though.
Okay, yeah. There's something interestingly similar to me about them, but... sorry. So, we have all these Batman sinks that came up with the Sandy Hook shooting. You know, I don't want to really revisit that too much, only for the fact that unless you feel strongly about it one way or the other, I don't think it's that huge a synchronicity. If someone said to me there's a frame in a movie that has the name of a town of something, I'd go, okay, that's cool. But I don't see like the idea of this sort of blew up, that so many people drew their eyes to it. I feel like there are much bigger synchronicities. My question to you is sort of what's your take on that? And then what I've been kind of saying, not trying to be offensive, but one of the things I've been trying to say is I don't think that's that big a synchronicity. How do you think people are going to handle if people are looking at one frame of a movie that has the name of a town being Sandy Hook? It's not like it was like the name of the town. It was just in a frame of a movie on a map. My question is, when there's some of those much bigger and hard to wrap your mind around synchronicities, how do you think people are going to process these?
It's tough to say, because I think that for the most part, people who aren't like intimately involved with synchromysticism or something along its lines, like when they see stuff like that, like the Sandy Hook frame in The Dark Knight, all they're really trying to do is get chills for a minute. You know, they're not really in it to explore things mentally and to really, you know, get into the meat of what it might mean. You know, they just want to be creeped out in a sense, and then they want to creep their friends out. You know, almost like when you watch a video that you just want to laugh about. You know, like you just want to be entertained. You know, sometimes people, they just want to be creeped out.
Yeah.
So, as far as like the mass of people embracing that, I really don't think that they were looking at it in terms of like a meaningful coincidence. You know, they were just like, this is creepy. You know.
But it's, I guess for me, there is a sect of people that's taking it as proof of a conspiracy.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think, I mean, there's always going to be a huge conspiracy crowd out there, and which I think is fine. You know, I think it's healthy to be into conspiracy. And, I mean, honestly, I think that this is a great one to spark the conspiracy conversation, because, you know, the fact that it is in the movie and that, you know, with the hurricane, you know, the Hurricane Sandy, I do think that it is enough to spark people's interest in conspiracy. And I'm glad that it's happening. You know, whether they find anything of significance, I have no idea. But I like it when people indulge conspiracy, even if it's something as stupid as one frame in a movie, like you said. You know, because I feel like conspiracy, it opens people's minds to the fact that everything that they know just might be wrong.
So. Oh yeah, I mean, I have a healthy, or I don't know, you know, you called it healthy. I guess I shouldn't judge myself, but it's a healthy respect for paranoid awareness. I mean, yes. there are things we should certainly be aware of. My question is, if you know, should we? I think we're at a point where we're trying to make a distinction, or I don't know. I know. I feel I am. I'm trying to make a distinction. You know, what is the consciously intentional thing that was inserted in? What is the thing that's just an interesting reverberation of the collective unconsciousness at the moment? Simply for the fact that if we're going to use the what would be a synchronicity as proof of a conspiracy, then everything's a conspiracy because everything syncs. So this is a sort of I think a dangerous territory, but it actually breaches a topic that I wanted to ask you in your Sync Book 2 chapter, which I love, where you've taken the sports metaphor and the idea that we can kind of go into what you actually lay out there, but there's this idea where you say what we see on the screen. It's easier for us to imagine. And if we can turn imagination into manifestation, once we've seen it in fiction, it becomes easier to actually manifest. Right. So my question to you, I have to raise the conspiracy question. Everyone says this is quote unquote predictive programming, or the very concept of predictive programming would be perhaps to tap into this, that if I can script something where you know, such and such happens, and everyone views it, and it's easier for them to imagine it in a weird sort of way. You're more likely to manifest it. If I write a movie that says Alan Abadesa wins the lottery and gets, you know, 30 billion blowjobs for the rest of his life, you know, and it becomes a blockbuster hit, does that actually, you know, increase the likelihood of that happening? Is there something to that idea?
I totally hear what you're saying. I think that, you know, that could spark an interesting take on the whole, like, going mainstream of the Illuminati nowadays with the internet. Because, like, you got to wonder if the conspiracy theorists and the hardcore conspiracy people are correct about, like, you know, the Illuminati has complete control over everything and, you know, they own the consciousness of all people, or at least they strive to, then why do they allow the internet to persist? And so along the lines of what you're saying, you know, maybe they want people to believe in conspiracy because then those people will manifest it. You know, maybe they want people to think, you know, this global cabal has a control over everyone's mind and they're creating this one world government. They want the average person to believe that because then the average person will manifest it. You know, that could be one take on it. I think that's kind of what you're saying. Yeah.
Oh, it's not what I'm. I'm raising it as a question.
Yeah.
I don't really feel that, like, deep in my heart. I don't feel that that's true. Right. But I certainly entertain that thought. I feel like I've had to entertain that thought because even when we talk about you know, finding esoteric symbolism in movies, I mean, we're able to pick apart most anything and say, okay, I can find this monomyth or this narrative, meta-narrative in the movie. But obviously there are some filmmakers who are, again, very well-informed and are putting things in completely consciously. And at what point do we, even let's just take it artistically, like, you know, at what point are we selling our artist short? If some guy really, you know, knows his stuff and makes this amazing masterpiece, and we're sitting there going, "Ah, oh, there's no way he knew that. That's a synchronicity." That being said, then there's the flip side, which is, speaking as someone who's done a lot of fiction writing, there, you know, I'm not the masterpiece guy. I'd love to be, but I'm more of a schmo who finds things later and goes, oh my God, I didn't realize what that there was this weird, all these things that I wish I had known about at the time were still put in there. That there's some things of my unconscious is speaking through me, you know, as this is classical muses or whatever it might be. And Bill, last time we spoke about it, compared this to a, there was a basketball metaphor. Bill, maybe you can reintroduce that. I don't remember what you called it.
We actually discussed it before you came on about the shooter's touch.
Okay, yeah.
Which, funnily enough, I wanted to call that episode Shooter's Touch, but I didn't want to. It seemed kind of un-PC.
Yeah, I was just thinking that that strangely syncs with what we're discussing now, you know.
Shooter McGavin.
Yeah, that's better.
You know what I'm talking about.
But, like, yeah, that whole notion of you can have this very, this sort of widespread media touching upon these kinds of themes so that it manifests in the public below.
Yeah. I mean, to me, like, I think that getting the public to believe things or getting anybody to believe something is, like, the ultimate form of what we would conventionally understand to be magic. So, like, if you take it in terms of, like, the movie Inception, you know, the real magic is getting somebody to believe something without them knowing that you're even in their head. And so the conspiracy and, like, the thought-out conspiracy is one that allows the idea of conspiracy to get into people's heads. But the conspirator doesn't want the public to know that they want them to know, if that makes sense.
That's
the ultimate way to get into someone's head. So, like, it's almost like they fashioned a conspiracy, like the Sandy Hook Dark Knight thing. And they want people to find it, but it has to be just visible or just invisible enough so that people don't know that they want them to find it, if that makes sense. Like, to me, that's like what magic and influence is. And if you believe that, you know, all the secret Illuminati societies or any regular person who practices magic, if you believe that what they're doing is magic, then that's what it is. That's it.
That's
it's putting
how,
putting
that's
a
how
frame
mind
in a movie.
Works, right?
That's how mind control works. It's putting a single frame in a movie and having people be like, you know, there's no way this could have happened, or having them be confused about it. And then your job as the magician is to steer that influence or to steer their mind, and whether it's putting more frames in a movie and making it more obvious or putting less and making it less obvious, you know, that's up to the skill and artistry of the magician involved.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Inception, because we started this call where I kind of ran over a rough sketch of this sync thread I've been following that has Giordano Bruno smack dab in the middle. And Giordano Bruno was known as the Nolan. So that fits in perfectly with Christopher Nolan.
Yes, perfect. And, you know, and the Nolan thing ties kind of loosely into Our Gods Wear Spandex with, I can't remember his name.
Oh, Knowles, yeah.
Christopher Knowles, yeah.
So I didn't even realize before when Malcolm McDowell was mentioned. I was like, Malcolm McDowell, so obviously A Clockwork Orange. But I posted here a link to this Photoshop thing I put together a while back, just putting different ideas together, and it didn't even occur to me that I initially Malcolm McDowell into this thread to do with the trading places, which looks like these guys made a killing in orange juice futures today. And how the orange was this big thing around a clockwork orange, and that the orange is the sun and the sun moves like clockwork or whatever. But I included him, first of all, because of the clockwork orange and its tie-in with that. But then also the fact that his name is Alexander DeLarge, and then Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind got its name from Alexander Pope. And she can't remember the Melancholia girl. What's her name?
Kate Winslet.
What is it? Kirsten Dunst. Kirsten Dunst can't remember if it's Alexander Pope or Pope Alexander, where it says, how happy is the blameless vessel's lot, the world forgetting by the world forgot, eternal sunshine of the spotless mind, each prayer accepted and each wish resigned. And what's interesting there is that the word for prayer actually literally translates. The Greek word for prayer literally means influence. If you look up the actual etymology of the word, it's to steer someone's mind, to make them change their mind. And I was realizing as you were talking that that's the, like, what, just what you were saying, that, you know, to the best form of mind control is to get someone to think that they're actually making the decision themselves, or that they're even like discovering something for themselves, like by themselves, even though they might be being pushed to discover it. And so, like, I have a personal theory about the death of John Lennon, that it was a CIA job. And I don't, you know, I'm not absolutely certain of that, but I feel that there's a really good argument for that, and specifically how that was done. And that would be it, would be through that kind of manipulation, where somebody has no idea that they were influenced or mind controlled, and then you can show all the reasons why or how that was done. And so I don't know, I just wanted to put that out there. I think it's kind of funny, the Malcolm McDowell's connection in Coming to America and how it ties in. But the one that got me, like, I put this thing together, I don't know if you guys are looking at it, but the Supertramp, how it's Alexander Supertramp is in the Into the Wild film. Isn't that what it's called? Into the Wild? Where he sits on the 142 bus. Are you here, Alan? Alan said hello.
Your audio cut out there for me. I don't know if everyone else can still hear you. I couldn't.
It came through loud and clear on this end.
Awesome. Okay.
I love how there's he calls himself Supertramp in Into the Wild, right? And he sits on the 142 bus and all of that. But how Supertramps came out with the album Crime of the Century. So we've all seen the Supertramp album where she holds the Lady Liberty holds up the orange juice in front of the two towers that have a 9/11 on it backwards. And
absolutely,
how Supertramp came out with this other album called Crime of the Century, which is an obvious reference to Superman 2. So you have Supertramp and Superman, and Superman 2, the prisoners are held in this like monolith and they're floating in space. And how when you look at the Crime of the Century album, you have this guy behind bars in space, which was, you know, it's totally that. But then how weird it is that Supertramp's like official big greatest hits album has the orange juice hand coming through those very bars, and how fucked up that level of it seems. So like, that's like a really uncanny sync there. If you take the fact that the orange juice is in front of the two towers, and here you have the Crime of the Century, the two together, it's expressing the literally crime of the century. It's 2001, right? And so I don't know. I thought that was kind of crazy.
Oh, that is crazy.
You know, we were talking about the ultimate mind control is trying to get someone to do something and thinking that they're doing it of their own volition. This ties back into what we were talking about, the kind of game that professional athletes are always playing. And I think it's best represented in something like chess. But that's what good basketball players are doing, and good professional athletes are doing, and good gamblers are doing whenever they go into that kind of event. Because if let's say in chess, you know, you want people to make moves based on them thinking that, you know, they don't, you know what I'm trying to say. You want your opponent to think that they're doing something that you don't know, but you've actually baited them into that move. Right. And with basketball, you know, good players one-on-one can get people to move because they think that that's the direction you're going in. And I think this is perfectly represented in something like poker, which you say, you know, most athletes are doing in their downtime. Is poker is the perfect situation where you get people to make bets, and they think that they don't realize that that's exactly what you wanted them to do.
Mm-hmm.
So people are working with this kind of magic every day. So maybe they're just, I'm wondering if becoming more in tune with that makes you more susceptible or makes you less susceptible.
Yeah. That's a good question.
And that would make it might be possible that they are more susceptible, because if an organization pays a player $100 million, you know, you might make it more susceptible for them to continue to make them money so that they get a return on their investment.
Right. That's like, so, you know, the film Revolver, which was Madonna's husband, Guy Ritchie, you know, they have this chess game that goes, and he's explaining just what you're talking about, where you feed your opponent the pieces so that they get the sense that they're in control and that they're top of it. And that's the basis for the whole movie. But then that's also, that film is presenting, admittedly so, if you look it up, it's all completely Kabbalistic. Every element is set according to the Tree of Life. And you could take the lightning bolt that moves down the tree, the 777 in the European system, as simply that, in a sense. It's like you're being fed, you feel that you're getting somewhere, but when really you're simply descending. So it's a manipulation that we play against ourselves in the first place. So it's not even that there's actually an outside, there's not even a need for an outside manipulator. We ourselves are the ones doing what we're doing in the first place. When the Adam looks down to the seven rings and then falls down and can't find his way back, that's him showing him, like, giving himself something of value that has no value, you know, in any real sense.
Right.
Hey, wait. So can we take that as a beautiful segue? Looking down through the seven rings, falling through them, this is the same thing as going down the rabbit hole, is it not? So when, if you, in the book Alice in Wonderland, there's something that I've been thinking about a lot lately is in the, like, first, I don't know, two pages of the book, right? She goes down the rabbit hole. And there's this weird thing that Lewis Carroll does, is he capitalizes this one phrase where she's falling down the thing and she picks up a bottle of, and then it's in all caps, orange marmalade. And I'm trying to figure out why he really felt the need to highlight the orange marmalade as she's falling down the rabbit hole. And of course, we could take this to Orange Sunshine, LSD, which, you know, would way predate anything like that. We have all the orange sinks you just laid out. But here we have the orange in the rabbit hole, and what I want to get to is, Joe. I mean, you made this video with all the Christopher Lloyd synchronicities, and for me, what I couldn't seem to wrap my head around is this crazy other idea. I loved when you had Gray's Sports Almanac as something alien, right? So, and then it occurs to me that he finds Gray's Sports Almanac next to the in the window next to the Roger Rabbit stuffed animal. So here we have the gray and the white rabbit put together in the window. But if you watch Roger Rabbit, that movie opens up, you know, there's a little like text on the bottom of the screen that says 1947. Like, it gives you a year that Roger Rabbit takes place. Well, that's the year of the Roswell crash.
Right. Holy right. shit.
Right. Yeah.
And then it's got the text right there.
That's wow.
Right. There was actually a bunch from Roger Rabbit that was removed. And I saw that shit when I was a kid. And when I watched it later, I swear, there's like a whole bunch of things. The baby said a bunch of stuff that he never said when it was released, and I was wondering about that, and I tried to look up to see if there was any information. No, they do that sometimes. There's things in the theater, and then when they come out on video, they're just totally shifted. Because there's so much hidden in that movie. I mean, I've freeze framed it when Jessica's spinning, and you can see the crotch shot, and there was another thing at the beginning. There's like subliminal shit all the way through it. They had a lot of fun with that. I don't know.
Alan, I never quite realized that, because you had told me before about the connection with the Roswell date and the 47 to where Roger Rabbit starts, but I never made the connection that it's the Grays and the White Rabbit. They interact twice, you know.
So. Yeah, it's something that I'm really trying to wrap my – so, you know, as was hinted at, I mean, I don't want to take this into my territory. I really want to focus on your work, but just to say – I've been writing this book about the JFK assassination, and like common synchronicities between JFK, 9/11, and the quote-unquote death of Bin Laden, which I'm a conspiracy theorist when it comes to most of those things. But the synchronicities, I feel like, need to be sort of examined. And again, I'm trying to figure out what's a synchronicity, what's intentional, what's whatever. So what there's this guy, James Shelby Downard, who wrote this essay called King Kill 33, and he's talking about all like this evil Masonic sorcery, he calls it. But quote, evil Masonic sorcery, that these evil Masonic sorcerers put this whole spell, and they're the ones who killed JFK and blah, blah, blah. But what's interesting is he's pointing out all these synchronicities in the JFK assassination. He sees it as evidence of magic, of black magic. Mm-hmm. So whatever, I'm not trying to present his argument, but I think he did some really interesting work. He found some really interesting things. And what he kept finding was this commonality between JFK and the first atomic bomb explosion, the Trinity explosion. Which, of course, what I'm noticing is, so I'm taking a larger scope on this, is he's right. I mean, there are really an intense amount of synchronicities around JFK assassination and the first atomic bomb explosion, which I see as the splitting of the atom, the splitting of the Adam, right? We could just go off in that stretch, and I have. But here's the thing. So the Trinity site is super close to the Roswell site. I mean, they're really, really close. Which
are
people
they?
Have. Oh, yeah. The first atomic bomb explosion and the Roswell crash are really, really close to each other. So some people take this as, well, this is obviously where the military was testing, so that Roswell crash had to be some sort of military secret test, because this is where they were doing their biggest secret, most secret test, right? Was would have been the atomic bomb. And, you know, if that's about as classified as you can get, that's where they were doing it. Other people see that there have been, in UFO reports, there's constant UFO reports in connection with nuclear weapons. And we, of course, see this in 2010, Year We Make Contact, right? This idea that the aliens come to stop the atomic war. But even in, like, real reports where you have all these like government officials who've come out and said, guys who like worked for the Navy or worked for different military bases, where they said the UFO came out and hovered over the silos, or the, you know, aliens came to me and they told me we have to stop atomic war. There's always this weird connection between aliens and atomic weapons. So all that being said, you know, this is things you can struggle to wrap your head around. But I found something that really I can't, so again, I just can't wrap my head around. So we have this idea of the rabbit connection. So JFK, of course, he gets shot, at least theoretically, by Lee Harvey Oswald. So Harvey is the invisible rabbit from the he's the Pooka, right? You guys familiar with that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I think in Roger Rabbit, he actually said, there's a scene where, I forget what the guy's name is, but the human guy, his friends are like, who are you talking to? And he's like, oh, you haven't met my friend Harvey? He's like joking about
it. Yeah. So it's Bob Hopkins.
Yeah.
But yeah, your Christopher Lloyd, connection, with, Buckaroo Banzai, fuck, dude, there was go on. It was the Restlean thing and Bill from Alice in Wonderland. I went through this whole thing with that, but go ahead.
Yeah, so, well, exactly. So, but I just want to quickly weigh this out, is I just want to put this out there, because this is something. So James Shelby Downard connects this whole thing, JFK, atomic bomb explosion, right? I find that there's this weirder connection between JFK and the Nagasaki bombing. So there's all these weird things, JFK, atomic bombs, of course, he's coming up, he's doing the atomic tests, there's political stuff around this. But I said, I want to see if there was an atomic bomb test on the day of JFK's assassination. So I find a record of every atomic test that was done, at least that they publicly admit to, every atomic test. And each one has like a weird name. So the first one was called Trinity. You know, they have a code name. So like code name Baker, code name Abel, whatever. So there was, yeah, the bomb. The spoiler here is that the bomb that goes off the day that JFK is killed, there is an atomic bomb test, and it's Operation Greys, plural, Greys. So this idea of, again, you know, breaking open the head, cosmic consciousness, and I like the direction you took this, is not, you're not pointing this out as evidence of alien contact per se, but what that alien contact would be a metaphor of. And I'm seeing as the king, Bill says, thank God it wasn't reptile. Yeah.
but it was, though. That was the weird thing. So if you guys have ever seen Communion and fucking Christopher Christopher Walken, another Christopher, takes the Grey's mask off and there's this fucking reptile behind it. And it's like a reptilian. And he's like, that's not it. That's not it. And the whole thing with so Dr. Bill Harford in Eyes Wide Shut, he's Dr. Bill, right? And his wife is Alice. And so you have this like the reptile from Alice in Wonderland connection to Dr. Bill, but then it's that the reptilian brain, the pineal gland, of course, Bill in Alice in Wonderland is the one running around with the ladder, and then she becomes too big for the house, which you could take the house is bait, right? Bait is taken as the body. If you're too big for your house, it's like, it reminds me of like the unatrophied, like pineal gland, right? That you're like too big for your own head or something. I was just going there with it in my mind at one point. But sync with Buckaroo Banzai, where it's what's his name again? I'm sorry. Christopher Lloyd at the end, and he's a fucking reptilian alien driving the car once again through the rabbit hole tunnel in LA. That was just too perfect. That's like there's like a couple points in your videos where I'm like, okay, wait a minute, what the fuck? Because that was the one that really drove it home. I couldn't believe that. That's really something.
That's the one that to me moves it beyond something that any rational, normal person could look at and say, this is nothing. You know, because I've showed that to people who are totally grounded in what I would consider normal, logical thought. And when they see that, they just say, you know, that there's something to this. And there's really no denying it. I mean, there's four instances where Lloyd appears on the end of this tunnel, you know, doing this the same storyline. So it's something for sure. And also, like, along the thread of what you were saying about the Greys and the rabbit hole, I was just thinking about this while you were saying it, but at the beginning of Roger Rabbit, where they give the Roswell date, so they say that, you know, Roger Rabbit is coming along at the same time, that same scene that they transition right into is the one where Roger has the refrigerator dropped on his head. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Yes.
But in the original...
And then Indiana Jones... in the refrigerator during the bomb and survives it.
Well, that's actually what was supposed to be the plot of Back to the Future. So Marty, when he's finding the Gray's Almanac next to the rabbit to power the time machine was actually originally supposed to be a refrigerator that was activated by being placed at Trinity or at the nuclear bomb site. So.
Wait, what? What?
Yeah, that was, if you read the original scripts of Back to the Future, that was what it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be him in a refrigerator at the detonation of the bomb, and that was supposed to be how it was powered.
Wow. So, and then, of course, the Indiana Jones is all around aliens and the Maya, right?
Right.
That's the whole thing, is that we're having alien contact.
And here you are finding this stuff in 2012.
Right. Well, we found you. I mean, I didn't. We just put that together just now. I mean, that wasn't a sync that I knew of before until you just told me all that stuff, so...
Your video. Yeah. So I guess, yeah. I mean, these were things that I saw your videos, and my thought, I was just astounded. Again, I have to agree with David. That Buckaroo Banzai, what do you call that, sink or whatever that is, that drove it way over the top. And I'm like, what do you even do with this? So I definitely, one of my thoughts though was like, wow, I haven't seen Roger Rabbit in forever. And I just really wanted to see it. And, that was, that was just, so just watching and seeing this idea of 1947, and I was just, that's what I took out of that. But this idea of the refrigerator now, but I'm saying, are you taking the refrigerator to the latest Indiana Jones with the refrigerator, atomic bomb, all this sort of stuff? Again, I guess my point was, if it's the aliens and the 2012 Maya is obviously what they were hinting at, then you have this idea that we step in with our own synchronicities. This is not something planned by the Illuminati, or maybe if it's the excellent sorcery that we're doing things that we didn't even realize we're doing, but here you are syncing with Indiana Jones discovering this, the hidden relics, the hidden artifacts in these old movies, but you're finding them in 2012. So there's this weird narrative that's being played out through us.
Right. It's like it only exists, retrospectively. Like there's no way they could have. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Or that's what they want us to think.
Yeah. It was all one elaborate inception.
They're not getting it. They're not getting it.
I just, by coincidence, I look over and I see I got all these Roger Rabbit trading cards in front of me. It's like, it's just different pictures, but I got these stickers and all this stuff, but I don't know where I'm going with this other than the fact that that's kind of weird. I mean, I got a lot of stuff around me, but Roger Rabbit trading cards are kind of fun. Sorry. I'd mention it.
Do you trade them with, David?
I don't trade them. I hoard them.
Right. So is that your World Trade Center would be your World Hoard Center? Oh, the horror. The Horde of Babylon.
Oh, God.
I would just love if you went to see like an official tarot card reading and thought it was really serious. And obviously David was running it and he suddenly starts pulling out Roger Rabbit trading cards instead of tarot cards.
Hey, that's a really interesting idea though.
I like the idea of that his insane idea is the freeway and how he want like he if you take it as like Lloyd our Christ bearer, like that it's Lloyd is the Christ. Just the idea that his evil plot is to create a freeway, and what a freeway is to be able to get places faster, easier, and there's no more barriers. You can pass and you can do whatever. It reminds me of like of the consciousness. Like looking at consciousness is like to expand consciousness is to realize that a lot of our boundaries are surmountable. And that we can basically move through walls, so to speak. It's like the freeway is a really good metaphor for that. And how it's taken as evil to create this freeway. You know, it's like, what kind of madman would come up with this?
Well, have you realized the synchronicity in there of, we talked about Douglas Adams in 42, what happens in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? They want to build they want to build a freeway through his home, and then they want to build the hyperspace highway. That's why they have to destroy Earth. So to build the freeway is to destroy Earth is this whole Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy story in itself. And then you have the idea that Steve Wollner and I had this conversation about that when we talk about unconsciously building something that is the microcosm and the macrocosm, is that the highways and freeways, and if you look at all this stuff, is basically like connecting synapses. So we're sort of building the same way we are doing with the internet and, you know, connecting information, connecting physicality. We're replicating our rivers and our which look like our bloodstream and all this sort of stuff. And we're building giant synapses. We're building a large scale planetary brain, which is what Earth was in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Earth was built as the giant machine to find out the question for 42.
Right, so, which is really interesting if you look at the Earth as Malkuth in that regard, because then you can say it's not enough just to simply push it to the bottom of the tree, but they actually set out in order to basically repair the tree to get rid of it completely. In the case, if you're looking at it through the lens of separation of Za'er from the Shekinah, then you could take it as like a desire for complete annihilation. Like if there is a how to reconcile the horror of Babylon would be in that case simply to destroy her, and an understanding that can't actually happen no matter what you want. And so to look at the Earth as Malkuth and then say that the Malkuth is designed in order to find the answer, you could say that there's a purpose to the separation. Like if the separation never occurred, we would never advance. It's like in order to take a step forward, you have to have an initial disequilibrium before you can get to another level, before you can find a new equilibrium.
Which is the story of... I'm sorry.
No, that's it. It's a story of creation. That's like what we're dealing with, right?
Right.
That's
like, which is like you said, it's what Lloyd is doing when he's demolishing Toontown in order to build this freeway, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's this idea of like of progress, and what does progress mean, and challenging us to look at the nature of that. It's the same thing with Nolan's Batman. I mean, you have these villains that are, you know, they're not easily reconcilable, because you're not just like, okay, these are the bad guys and these are the good guys, because he shows the psychology of both sides. Like when you know, the Joker burns that big pile of money and then says everything burns, that speaks to a part of us that is just like, yeah, everything burns, like, what are you afraid of, you know? And this is fucking paper, like, what it, you know? And of course it's in the shape of a giant pyramid. Just, it couldn't be any more poignant, but at the same time it's just expressing that conundrum of consciousness, right?
I wanted to bring up, I forgot that the videos that you make point to Lloyd as the Christ bearer. And I just wanted to speak to how most people can nowadays look at a film, and without it explicitly being mentioned, they can say, oh, well, clearly that's a Christ figure in a movie, right? That's not necessarily an overpowering revelation. And that's something that people will readily say, well, of course the director meant that. You can see by blah, blah, blah. So that's a sort of, you know, subtextual narrative that people can grasp onto, and they don't think there's any kind of conspiracy behind it. It's just a widely accepted way of making a narrative stronger.
Right.
The thing is that if you go beyond simple Christianity and go to the roots, and you have a working background of Kabbalistic theory, the symbolism of the tarot, the symbolism of the Tree of Life, then you realize that most of these directors and writers who are constructing these narratives are very clearly putting those subtextual narratives into their story. So it's like a telescope. It depends on the lens of the viewer to see how deep they want to look into a movie. The problem is that no one wants to spend the time building the lens necessary to look into these works of cinema. I guess it's easier to look at movies, because movies are easily digestible within 2 hours. But I think once you start to get involved with this stuff, you start to see this in different works of art and different works of literature. And then before you know it, your whole head is spinning. So I guess what I wanted to ask you, Joe, is, why do you think you were able to piece together the density, like the video that you put out with the Christopher Lloyd series? How the hell did you transcend from a simplistic Christ subtext into the kind of video that you produced? Can you pinpoint something specifically, or was there a body of literature that you read that prepared you for that? Or was it, you know?
Yeah, well, first I want to say it was interesting that you articulated the word density in the exact way that George McFly articulates it when he says it to Marty's mother in the cafe. I know that sounds strange, but I've heard it so many times that you really articulated it exactly like he did. You can play back the recording, and he actually confuses the word density with destiny, and that's actually my answer, which is, like, I feel like, you know, it's the destiny of individuals to extrapolate this information from these films, because I feel like the authors and the producers or the writers of the films that stick with people, like, you know, there's hundreds of them, but just to name a few, like Back to the Future is one, like The Wizard of Oz, all like the classics that for some reason just like speak to our soul. You know, I feel like the writers incorporate things that inherently speak to our soul. So for that reason, people are destined to eventually start to extrapolate these deeper things because they never stop looking at them. And that's like what happened with me with this, with Back to the Future, for example. Like, I just never stop looking at it, simply because there's something there speaking to me. And so, like, so my answer to you is, like, I was able to get this information from it, one, because it's there, and the reason that it's there, the fact that it's there is the reason why I don't stop looking at it, even though I consciously don't understand what is there. You know what I mean? Like, and what I believe is going on is I think that the people who wrote these classics that have like these embedded meanings that speak to us, like, you know, the Greys and their connection to the rabbit, I believe that when they were young, they did stuff like the three of you and me, like we're sitting here doing now. I believe they sat around and they talked about what is magic. You know, it's just influence. You know, what is the Kabbalah? Like, what is all this mystical stuff and what does it mean and how does it speak to the soul of humans on a deeper level? And I think that after, you know, decades of being involved in this kind of stuff, they then just casually wrote about their experience in life, like much in the way like Alan, you were saying that, you know, you write fiction. Well, eventually, you know, all this stuff that we talk about is going to find its way into your work, whether you're consciously trying to manipulate people or not. And so I think that, and since this stuff speaks to people on a deep level, eventually, once it gets incorporated into your works, you know, it's going to start speaking to people on a level that they're like, I don't know why, but I have to keep looking at this piece of fiction. I have to keep looking at it. And when they keep looking at it, they're going to start extrapolate the stuff that we're sitting here talking about. And so that's my answer. I think that's what happened with Back to the Future. It really does contain just the deepest stuff that speaks to us on a level that we don't even know is going on. So,
I just had a fucking huge revelation. Oh, sorry. I just want to put this out there as quickly as I'm able. So I was considering that Christopher Lloyd literally means the Christ bearer, the one who bears the cross, isn't that literally?
It's holy. Yeah, his first name is Holy Man, and then the one who bears Christ.
Okay, so if you look at it that way, I mean, Kabbalistically, there's this whole thing around the three vavs, the three nails that hold up Jesus, which is 666, right?
Exactly.
That's why it's a number of the sun. But that is actually literally the force that's pulling the tree apart. And it's Christ is the one bearing the cross is the one that holds the tree apart. The Malkut is, it literally translates as empire. Most people translate it as kingdom, but it's the idea that in order to build an empire, you first have to do this thing. You have to set the foundation, and that foundation is the Christ holding the tree apart. And so if you look at it through that lens, you can see, like, first of all, you have, you know, he's Doc, right? He's Doc Brown, but it's I'm looking here at a quote. It says, unfortunately acquires something with a little more kick, plutonium. And Pluto is the furthest planet in the solar system, right? Which is a significance of Hades and the underworld and all this. And he goes, oh, plutonium, whoa, Doc, do you mean to tell me this sucker is nuclear? No, this sucker is electrical, but I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity I need. And so there's this whole thing of that the split Adam is taken as a metaphor, or perhaps more than a metaphor, as the split atom. And so to have the, you know, to generate the electricity to do the thing, you have to first split the thing. And that is literally the Christ as the tree. And so you have this, like, nuclear Jesus idea. It's just, I don't know, it's kind of interesting, especially that Jesus is literally a Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, which is a tetragrammaton, which are the four parts of the tree, with a shin in the center, showing that it's separating the tree, literally in the name, and that the shin is the three pillars of the tree. You take the three lines, but it's also taken as three vavs with a yud on top, so also ultimately three zions. So it's both 666 and 777 at the same time.
Right. I just want to add to that real quick. So you're talking about this nuclear Jesus concept, and they have to split this atom to break apart in order to unleash this great power, and that, you know, it's done by whatever Christ consciousness archetype you know is doing it. And in this case, it's Christopher Lloyd. So in the case of Back to the Future, the three nails of the Christ bearer, or this nuclear Jesus, is represented by the flux capacitor, which is what, you know, he says makes time travel possible. If you look at the flux capacitor, you know, it's the three nails of the cross. Or what I like to say is, like, if you imagine Jesus on the cross, you know, in his Y shape, he is the flux capacitor. At least that's what I say. You know, Jesus on the cross is the flux capacitor. So
it's also in the shape of a Y, like the flux
capacitor. It's the Y. Yeah, it's,
you could take it as the Yud, which is the fire.
Exactly. Actually, there was a point where I was looking for the shin on either flanking the flux capacitor. Like, I was hoping there'd be a logo on the passenger and the driver's seat of the DeLorean, thinking that it would be actually the name, you know, with the Y in the middle and the shin flanking it. But I couldn't find it. But definitely the Y as the three points on the cross representing Jesus, to me, is what the flux capacitor is.
Sure. Yeah. Holy fuck.
Yeah. I was in this one passage in this book on the Rosicrucian Enlightenment that Yeats writes. She talks about a writer named Comenius. And this cat was kind of, if I understand it correctly, he saw that the Rosicrucian momentum that was stamped out due to the 30 Years' War and then resurrected with the Royal Society. And the Royal Society was kind of acknowledged as being sort of an invisible college that was visible. So a sense that it was carrying on the work, but it was doing carefully in the light. But he feared that it was geared more towards strict science, with kind of leaving out some of the magic and Kabbalah that would be threatened by witch scares that would happen every so often. And, you know, heretics were burned or killed. So he kind of was behind the Royal Society, but the thing that he feared was that in their cultivation of scientific knowledge, if the ends of just pure science without magic and Kabbalah, he felt that they were building a Babylon Tower that was in reverse, so that it wasn't being built towards the heavens, that the tower was being built towards the earth. And I think if you think of science removed from magic and Kabbalah and in tune with natural magic, I think the ultimate crashing of that Babylon Tower being built towards earth would be an atomic bomb being used as a weapon of war, that you somehow got it all wrong, that you, because you stripped it of a certain essential component, you did something in the wrong direction. And I don't think it's ever more clear than using something as powerfully magical as the splitting of the Adam to kill 200,000 people.
Right.
And to sort of handcuff a whole planet underneath this fear of instant annihilation. And I just kind of see that is this cat in, like, you know, the 1600s, he kind of saw this whole thing, the whole architecture of this fall of this Babylon Tower towards Earth happening right in front of his eyes.
So this is hugely significant, Bill. This notion is also expressed as the reversed tree. When you look at the tree of life, you're supposed to, in order to see how it corresponds to your own being, it's as if you step directly into it, whereas people have a tendency when looking at it to reverse it. And so there's this idea of the other tree that's basically ruled by Lilith, all this business that is taken over by demons. It's also taken as the underside of the tree, the backside of the tree, or the reverse of the tree. Now, if you look at the tree itself as a mirror, because if you were to step into it, you're literally stepping directly. You're not having to reverse anything. It's why actually in the Sync book I named my chapter, I had the title in there as Mirrors Work One Way, Windows Two, or reverse that, Windows Work Two Ways, Mirrors One, is that if you look at a window, you have duality. You have one side and the other. Where you have a mirror, all it does is reflect back to you. If you have a relationship to your perception and you take it, you look at it in the wrong way, then you end up with the reverse kind of actions. And so I had considered that as well, that the idea of the atomic bomb is when you take it so far in the extreme direction, you get the correspondence of what would be the illumination, but on the opposite end. And so, of course, it's like so appropriate that we call, like, plutonium, like plutonium for Pluto, right? Like, that's like the as far into the underworld as you can get. It's like when we reach the zenith of how far we can go in the reverse direction.
Didn't Eddie Murphy, because we talk about Eddie Murphy as the, you know, the son of the Lion King in Trading Places, the guy who reinstitutes the Twin Towers, wasn't he in a movie called something Pluto?
Tower Heist.
Yeah, that too, but he was in a movie called something Pluto, or like Pluto Jones, or some like weird ass like that.
Nash Pluto, I think. Was it Nash Pluto?
Pluto Nash. His name is Pluto. So I was waiting for,
For Pluto
that.
Yeah. And he's an astronaut? I never saw that shit.
There's a lot of his stuff that's in the haven't seen that shit category, I think.
Wow, but it's got some sync value here for sure. Look at that. I don't know if you guys are looking at the same thing here, but yeah, look. That's funny.
So I dropped this thing into the connection was Adventures of Pluto Nash. There you go. So he looks like he's almost wearing that same Dave Bowman outfit, but that's interesting. So anyway, yeah. I dropped I dropped this thing in, which was an old TV show. I thought it was had to be like, I don't know, like an Outer Limits or something. But it was apparently TV show called Night Visions. And it was this thing that I had seen with Malcolm McDowell. And this is just going to back up just ever so slightly. When you talked to this idea of all this stuff, of like us keeping the story going, I was able to find this thing. It was an episode that aired September 24th, 2002. So that means this is 1 year after 9/11. Malcolm McDowell was in this TV show called Night Visions. The episode is called Patterns. This little IMDb thing doesn't tell you much. It just says, a psychiatrist tries to cure an obsessive patient but acquires his compulsion. For some reason, I've seen this TV show, this particular episode, multiple times. Never knew what I was watching, but I saw this same episode multiple times, and it's like Malcolm McDowell, who goes through this like weird set of almost like OCD type things, where he says like, I have to do this or the world falls apart. So he has to like, you know, pat his head 30 times and then do whatever. And if I don't do this, the world's going to fall apart. And the psychiatrist convinces him that he's has OCD, and he finally, it's exactly like Dr. Parnassus, when, you know, like, you know, Tom Waits silences them all and says, you see, nothing happened. The world's still here. But in this one, basically the psychiatrist finally convinces Malcolm McDowell that he has OCD and he should stop. And as soon as he stops, the world starts falling apart. And the psychiatrist, when it says, but acquires his compulsion, I'll give away a spoiler here, the psychiatrist says, tell me what to do. What do I do? And he's like, pat your head 30 times, then do this. And he starts doing it, and the world goes back to normal. And then Malcolm McDowell is like, basically, like, I'm free. It's sort of like the genie type thing. It's like, oh, good. And Malcolm McDowell knows, now I don't have to do it anymore. Now you'll do it.
Yeah. But the psychiatrist is Miguel Furrer, which is the bad guy in RoboCop, which is Buckaroo Banzai.
Is that Buckaroo Banzai?
Yeah, it's the same guy who was in Naked Lunch, William S. Burroughs movie.
Yeah, I know.
He's the asshole in Twin Peaks, too.
Yeah, I know this. He's in Buckaroo Banzai? I mean, I still haven't seen
Buckaroo. No. I'm saying that the guy, Peter, what's his name?
Oh, right.
The guy
RoboCop. Oh, okay.
I was just saying, Sink Frog.
Got you. Yeah, and of course, he's in Twin Peaks, the Twin Towers, yeah.
Yeah.